Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's day 18 of the partial government shutdown. 420,000 federal employees are working without pay. An additional 380,000 workers have been forced to stay home, and if the shutdown extends into the weekend, it will be the longest-running government shutdown in American history. But we've been here before. It all dates back to 1974 and the passage of the Congressional Budget Act. That's when the Congressional Budget Office was established, and the president and Congress had to work together to avoid funding gaps. And sometimes that didn't happen, which led to shutting down the government. Since 1974, there have been 21 shutdowns, including the one we're in today. This time around, 47% of American adults hold President Trump responsible for the freeze, while 33% say Democrats are to blame. That's according to a poll from Reuters and Ipsos conducted at the end of last month. And some of you say they're just blips on the political landscape.
This is Bill from Seattle. The shutdown does not impact my vote. And I was in the military for several past shutdowns, and it's never been more than an inconvenience for me or my family.
This is Laura calling from Hanson, Mass. The federal government shutdowns have never had an impact on my vote. This is primarily because I usually cannot remember who caused the shutdowns and why they caused the shutdown after it's over. But maybe if it was brought up at election time, it might change my mind.
Others of you remember these stalemates on election day.
I remember in the 1970s that my spouse and I were without pay for 3 days when the government shut down, and we were stationed in Germany with the military. I definitely held the government, including Jimmy Carter, responsible for that.
This is Tucker Ranson from New York City. I think that shutdowns are irresponsible, and I vote accordingly.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Let's get started. To find out more about the history of shutdowns as a strategy, I'm joined by Roy Myers, professor of political science and affiliate professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Welcome to the show, Roy.
Good to be here.
So we mentioned that Congress has only had the power to shut down the government since 1974. But did the government shutdowns look the same back then as they do today?
Well, in 1974, that's when it enacted the Congressional Budget Act. The most important historical action that led to shutdowns was a decision by the Attorney General Benjamin Civiletti in 1980, who said that when there was a funding gap, that is when Congress and the president didn't agree to an appropriation bill on time, then agencies that lacked that funding would have to shut down. And after that, during the Reagan years, there were 8 short shutdowns that lasted at most 3 days. And then there was a short one during the George H.W. Bush shutdown presidency, where he, in effect, told Republicans to vote for the tax increases that helped reduce the deficit in the agreement with the Democrats.
One of the longest shutdowns, as you know, was sort of a showdown, if you will, between President Clinton and the then House Speaker Newt Gingrich. And during that shutdown, we heard Newt Gingrich take a pretty bold stance. Here's how he described it.
To the best of my knowledge, I can tell you without equivocation, no one has talked to me today about any so-called revolt. I just left 60 of the freshmen who are very happy with what we're doing. We've had, I think, 7 hours of leadership meetings in the last 2 days.
What was Gingrich's political strategy there?
Well, Gingrich had won a big election victory in 1994. The Republicans took over control of Congress, and they decided that they were going to impose on President Clinton the Republican vision of what should happen to the U.S. government, which was to shrink its spending. So they were insisting that President Clinton sign appropriations bills that would provide far less funding than President Clinton wanted. So they had an impasse in their negotiations. And so Gingrich and the Republicans decided to, in effect, to use the funding gap to shut down government agencies and call Clinton's hand. What they failed to realize it was that President Clinton was a very wily negotiator, and in particular, he was very good at connecting with the public, repeating incessantly that Republicans were attacking what he called MMEE, which stood for Medicare, Medicaid, Education, and the Environment. And President Clinton convinced the public that he was right and the Republicans were wrong, and the Republicans eventually caved and compromised on their own. It did lead to some spending cuts, but far smaller spending cuts than Gingrich wanted.
As you're describing this, one of the things that I'm wondering, and I think we're hearing some folks asking these questions, is these shutdowns have become, at least they feel like they've become, political games of chicken, where really not much is getting done. Have shutdowns become a political tool?
They very, very much are games of chicken. Whether they're a sensible political tool is a good question, because I'm not familiar with any games of chicken that end up well. And in this particular case, I believe that the proponents of the shutdown will hurt their political reputation, just like it hurt the Republicans in 1995 and 96, and then again in 2013 when another long shutdown took place.
We know in this shutdown, President Trump initially said he would take responsibility for it. He's had a lot of bluster around his positioning on this shutdown. But some of the blame is going to Democrats. And what's the strategy here in terms of blaming your opponents during a shutdown?
Well, in part, that's because a lot of Americans engage in what is called partisan motivated reasoning. That is, they tend to take information from the politicians they support and particularly accept blame being cast on the politicians that they oppose. So many Republicans will listen to President Trump and blame the Democrats, and many Democrats will listen to the Democratic leaders and blame President Trump. However, there are a number of people that don't rely solely on that partisan motivated reasoning. And in this particular case, as you said at the beginning, the polls seem to show that President Trump is going to be blamed more for this than the Democrats. And that's quite understandable, because in that press availability before the shutdown, President Trump willingly accepted blame before the fact.
President Obama also oversaw a 10-day shutdown in 2013. Let's take a listen to his approach on how to deal with that.
The only thing we can't do is to engage in an extortion game where you threaten to shut down the government, hurt a lot of people, or ultimately hurt the entire U.S. economy.
Roy, are we in that moment right now in this extortion game?
I believe that some of the Republican leadership believes that that would be successful, in particular the acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, a former member of Congress from South Carolina, and the OMB director repeatedly has said during his service in Congress that he thought a shutdown would be a useful way of shrinking government. And his colleague in Congress, Mark Meadows, who's head of the Freedom Caucus, has said the same thing. However, you know, if you're going to extort somebody, you want to have something that they really want to have. And the Republicans are not in that position, because many Americans have come to understand that a shutdown deprives them of important government services. And when we get to the point when, for example, if this were to continue into February, when people lose food stamp funding or other main benefits that are administered by people who in the government would no longer be working, that's going to be a real problem for the Republicans.
Also, you know, the president has also said that he's spoken to federal employees who have, despite their concerns about not getting paid, are still supportive of the shutdown. Whether or not that's true, Roy, can you give us a sense for how long that level of support, that partisan political support, will last while people are not getting paid? I mean, isn't there a limitation to how much people will support any administration when their pockets are empty?
Yes, it will erode steadily, but particularly when, say, for example, federal workers don't receive their paychecks as they are due at the end of this week. Now, there are probably some people, such as some Border Patrol agents, who have allied themselves with the president regarding funding for, quote, the wall, end quote. But I think that's a relatively small percentage of federal civil servants. Most federal civil servants are very interested in serving the American public, regardless of who is controlling the government as elected officials, and they want to be at work and they want to be paid for serving the public.
How long? I mean, we've got a couple of, there are about 30 seconds left. Are you expecting this to make any moves, this shutdown, to actually continue into the weekend?
Yes, it's going to have to continue through the weekend because Congress will not be able to pass bills very quickly, even if the president declares an emergency, as he's been threatening to do tonight. That in fact, if he does that, will be a massive political challenge to the Congress. And if President Trump thinks he's going to get out of this situation by going that route, I think he's sorely mistaken.
Roy Myers is a professor of political science at the University of Maryland. Thank you so much, Roy.
Thank you.
Trade negotiations are underway this week between the U.S. and China as both sides hope to iron out a lasting deal. The Trump administration has sent a delegation to Beijing where both sides are racing against a March 1st deadline when a temporary freeze on further tariff increases will expire. But if they can't come to an agreement...
At the end of 90 days, these tariffs will be raised on $200 billion from 10% to 25% if we don't get a satisfactory solution.
That's U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, a cabinet-level official who has a knack for flying under the radar. This week, the U.S. is being represented by Lighthizer's number two, Jeffrey Gerrish. For insight into these talks, I'm turning to Matt Peterson, senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes about global affairs. Matt, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
So what is at the heart of the trade dispute slash tension between the U.S. and China?
This is about more than trade. These are two sides that see the world very differently, and particularly Robert Lighthizer, we just heard from, sees the world very differently from a lot of his predecessors who held that top trade negotiating job. He really sees this as a big picture struggle between the forces of at least economic freedom and democracy and China and its authoritarian government. So there's a lot of trade disputes at stake here. There's soybeans that the Chinese are not buying at the moment. There's technology that they're blocking and messing around with. But there's some bigger things at stake when Lighthizer is talking.
So how is that different from what we've seen in the past with folks who have had this position in the past? Have they not seen China as that much of a threat, or have they been more willing to work with China?
Both. So they, past U.S. trade negotiators, have certainly thought that China was a problem, and they have pushed pretty hard to try to do things about it. So in the Obama administration, for instance, you had the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which is a big trade deal that was meant in part to deal with China. But it came at it in a very different way. That was working with American allies to try to come up with a big global approach to convince everybody to work together, whereas Lighthizer here is now just kind of taking a hammer to the relationship. He really supports all these tariffs that have gone up. They're mostly his plan, his strategy. And he has a very confrontational, aggressive style that doesn't really match with past holders of his job.
What kind of changes do Lighthizer and the Trump administration really want to see China make in these negotiations, particularly when it comes to trade policy with the U.S.? We talked about soybeans. I feel like there are urns and urns of soybeans sitting in some farm in the middle of the U.S. What's going on? What do we want to see?
Well, that's certainly part of it. I mean, the Chinese have basically stopped buying American soybeans in retaliation for the tariffs that we put on them.
And that's hurting who?
That's hurting American farmers. Absolutely. I mean, it's hurting Chinese consumers too. But certainly if you go out to the Midwest, there are soybeans that are not going anywhere right now. And that's a problem for American farmers. But there's bigger things at stake here, right? And that's really the question, is what are those bigger things that Lighthizer in particular wants? I mean, what Trump wants is, I couldn't tell you. But what Lighthizer has said that he's trying to do is get the Chinese to restructure their economy in 90 days. That's what he said on Face the Nation a couple weeks ago. I don't know how that's possible. It doesn't seem terribly realistic, which makes me think he's bearing down for a protracted trade dispute with China. I mean, fundamentally, what they want is for the Chinese to be more fair to American companies and do things like stop spying on companies that build aircraft, for instance, stop stealing secrets from American companies, stop hacking the American government. So they want these big picture changes that would allow American companies, particularly high-tech companies, to be more competitive. But it's sort of hard to see how they're ever going to get there from where we are right now.
I was going to say, these don't sound like outrageous expectations, but without some sort of partnership involved here, I don't see how we're going to get there. What does China want from us?
at the moment, what China wants to do is really defend the status quo. The Communist Party, which runs China, wants to keep people employed, keep growth happening. Right now, we're seeing economic growth in China slowing a little bit, which is bad news for the people in charge who want Chinese citizens to be happy and have jobs. So they're worried about what this coming economic slowdown, which seemed to may have been coming even before the trade dispute started.
Our economic slowdown, their economic slowdown.
Well, now we slow down
together.
Everyone's
economic slowdown.
That's okay. The thing is the American and Chinese economies are so closely linked right now that if one of them went into recession, the other one would probably go into recession too. So that's important to keep in the back of your head when all this stuff is happening. I mean, you know, there was a lot of talk last week about Apple, which said that it had been hurt by slowing iPhone sales in China. Well, Apple's an American company and employs a lot of Americans. So, you know, the Trump administration gets out and says, like, well, they should expect this to happen because they should be building iPhones in the United States. Well, these companies aren't national anymore. They exist across a bunch of different countries, and they employ people wherever they are. And so when these companies start to fail, Americans are going to feel it.
This administration, as we're seeing right now happening down with the issue on the southern border, two completely different things, but this is not an administration that has necessarily taken a diplomatic, open-ended approach to dealing with these types of issues. So my sense is that unless one or the other bends, we're going to see tariffs going into the near future, no? I mean, I just don't see China or the U.S. bending either way right now.
What's really happening here is that the Chinese are giving little concessions along the way to give Trump something to attach himself to and say, here's a win, here's a political win, I've got something. So we're going to see this dynamic happen where the Chinese are going to try to get away with as little as they can possibly do without giving up any of that really big stuff about sort of how the Communist Party is involved in running companies in China, which would really change the whole political and economic model of the country. That's the stuff that they can't really give away easily. So they're trying to give away this sort of small stuff about soybeans, for instance. Not small stuff to people who make soybeans, but in the grand scheme of the relationship, it's not what the fight's about. So what may happen is that you may see some small concessions on this, and Trump may say, hey, let's do it. This looks like a win. I mean, he's done this before a lot, but Lighthizer really doesn't want that to happen. He's trying really hard to go for the big stuff in the relationship. And so this is the question that we should be watching over the next few weeks and months is, are we going to keep fighting for these bigger things that people like Bob Lighthizer want, or are we going to stop and say, we'll figure that stuff out later?
Matt Peterson is a senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you very much.
For years in the music and entertainment industry, there's been an open secret. Everyone knows, but no one wants to talk about it.
For nearly three decades, R. Kelly has been preying on young and vulnerable women, black women mostly, and he has built an ecosystem around his predation.
Dream Hampton is a filmmaker, activist, and executive producer of the new docuseries Surviving R. Kelly. It documents decades of alleged abuse by the R&B star, from charges of child pornography in the 90s to current allegations of holding young black girls in a kind of sexual cult. The series aired last week on Lifetime and reveals details about his alleged crimes through dozens of interviews with people from Kelly's life. Now, as social media has exploded with reaction, Dream says a frightening picture is finally starting to take shape of a man whose dark past has gone largely ignored for years.
I think that the level of sadism involved in what he was doing really surprised me. We should say, and we definitely say it in the documentary, that he was the victim. He was raped from 7 to 14. So he was severely abused as a child, and I'm certain has not a clue about what a healthy framework and healthy sexuality is or should be. That said, he's 51, and to this day, in January of 2019, there are two sets of parents still trying to get their daughters back. One of them, Azriel Clary, was 17 when she thought she was entering a relationship with him, and he knew by Florida law he was committing statutory rape. The other one was a post-teenager. She was 19. And we had to cooperate this. Trust me, Lifetime and Buna Murray have all kinds of legal departments. So we had to get testimony, and we stack it in the documentary this way. In fact, it can be relentless to have to listen to this over and over again. But the testimonies all line up that they are denied food, that they are denied movement, that they are physically abused. So yeah, they are there to kind of please him sexually. And that includes being filmed without permission. That includes being forced into sex acts with people that they don't know.
How is it that R. Kelly has been able to remain protected?
On a micro level, the answer to that question has to do with a series of closed doors and a very compartmentalized and literally cordoned off way that he does what he does. And by that, I mean that we have testimony from, say, Geronda Pace, who he met at his trial and began sleeping with when she told him she also was a teenage fan of his. Beyond ironic, it's just an incredible amount of hubris. And she has testimony about being at the house, knowing that her friend was in the house, but because they were restricted to certain rooms, they couldn't find one another. They tried to meet up in the bathroom. They had to get permission from R. Kelly to leave their rooms, which often had locks on the outside of those doors. That's a metaphor for the amount of control that he has exercised in his life. I once did an interview with him, a profile of him for Vibe magazine, post his marriage to Aaliyah and the annulment of that marriage, but pre the news about kind of the pattern of his predatory behavior being broken by Jim DeRogatis. And I didn't see it either. And I want to kick myself about it, and I take responsibility for that. But now that I know how he operates with these closed doors, I see how I didn't see it. At the same time, in terms of the larger issue, I think that we want to look away. I think that we're complicit in a way. And by we, I mean, Harvey Weinstein has made some of my very favorite movies. You know, I mean, he produced some of the best independent films that have come out of the United States in the past 30 years. So there is this way that we don't want to look at the person behind, you know, these works of art that we may connect to.
Why has this been going on? You said it's part of the infrastructure that he's built around him, but how has it been able to go on for this long?
As someone who has spent my adult life, you know, being critical and organizing against the systemic injustice that is our criminal justice system, our criminal justice system, I find it ironic, and a lot of Black people have this experience of knowing what this system is like, that we are looking for justice from the criminal justice system. We had a judge who, when R. Kelly went to trial, would not allow the fact that he had married Aaliyah, who was 15, which is statutory rape. They wouldn't allow that information in there. They wouldn't allow other lawsuits into that trial. They wouldn't let the jurors hear that. So that judge is accountable. We had jurors who, and we have a juror in our documentary who talks about not believing these girls, which has everything to do with race. He didn't like the way they looked and the way that they dressed, which has everything to do with race and gender.
Because it's hard, because Black girls don't get believed.
He was a Romanian immigrant, and yeah. Maybe her silk blouse was too bright a color for him. Absolutely. So, yes, women across the spectrum don't get believed.
There's another element to this, and it's the fact that there were many of the people who worked with R. Kelly in terms of being musicians or otherwise, other celebrities, did not come forward to participate in this film. Can you tell us why?
I don't like that this... I get that I said it in an interview and I named the people who didn't come forward, but I don't like that it's the headline. It's true. I invited almost anyone who had ever said something about him or, well, I didn't invite them, but I have a producer, Tina Ferris, who has an amazing relationship with most people in the industry, who invited people like Erykah Badu, who was quoted as saying that R. Kelly has done more for Black people than anyone else, who invited, you know, Jay-Z, who did a tour with him after he was acquitted from this trial, who asked Lady Gaga if she would come on camera after her SNL performance with him not 2 years ago. So, of course, those people were invited. But I also invited Barry Weiss, who was the president of Jive and ran RCA Jive Records. I invited people from his record label who worked with him for two decades. I invited all kinds of people to come forward, and many, including police who were involved in the case, prosecutors, attorneys, many, many people said no. And their silence is complicity.
Let's talk a little bit about the reaction to the film itself that you've gotten. You've gotten a lot of support. My social media Twitter timeline is lit up with this, and it has been for days now. But there's also been some criticism, no?
Of course, there should be. I'm a critic. There was a wonderful review written in the New York Magazine that had some problems in it, but talked about some of the cutaways, talked about that kind of reality TV, you know, talking about justice and then having a gavel come down on the cut. And I thought that that was such a good review of kind of the aesthetic problems of working at networks like Lifetime and with Buna Murray, which I'd never done before. But the most important criticism that I've gotten is having Charlamagne, who's a radio personality in New York City, on to talk about R. Kelly when he himself was, a story broke after the interview, but we definitely included him after the story broke, that he himself was accused about 10, 15 years ago of sexual assault. So that criticism is one that I have to look at. And I have to be honest, I was desperate for Black men. We definitely limited the amount of time that he got. He was so clear and so forceful in his condemnation about R. Kelly. If I could have interviewed him, and if I would have interviewed him after the story broke about the sexual assault allegations in his own past, I would have asked him to reckon with it on camera. But I wish that I had not included him in this documentary.
We are seeing the hashtag Mute R. Kelly is back. Do you think that he will get a public reckoning himself, or do you think that this has spurred a necessary conversation about not just R. Kelly specifically, but about how the lack of attention paid to this type of sexual abuse, and particularly within the African-American community?
Yeah, I mean, this, I cannot take credit for creating this conversation or even opening it. This is a conversation that we have to have every generation. I can remember when The Color Purple came out and the kind of, you know, Alice Walker, like how she was attacked on all sides by men and women in our community. Yes, this film has done way more than I thought it would. I wasn't even sure that young people were interested in R. Kelly. And I knew that they may not have all of the facts. But now it's the job of people who are trained and who have been working around gender violence, domestic violence, sexual violence for decades to take the lead, to organize, to create study guides, to organize town halls, and yeah, to support people like Mute R. Kelly.
Are you expecting some sort of action, if you will, from anyone from RCA Records who still has R. Kelly signed to maybe some sort of criminal, I don't know, some other steps beyond this?
In terms of charges that might be outstanding, of course the Clarys have talked to their local Florida County Sheriff's Department, Police Department. They've even talked to the FBI. Will these people take it up? This is a part of the systemic injustice that victims and survivors of sexual violence face every day.
And we know that the Me Too movement, hashtag Me Too, was started by Tarana Burke more than a decade ago. But this has since started up again last year with this resurgence on social media. Do you think a lot of those folks have also been white? A lot of the people, the accusers and the accused, have been white. And a lot of the attention has been on white content creators since then. What about this? Is this the start of a hashtag Me Too for Black women?
I think that Black women have been at the forefront of organizing against sexual violence in our own communities since we've been here, you know? So whether it's Bill Cosby, which absolutely became a story in our community because of the leadership and organizing of Black women, whether it is Rick Ross, I can remember the organization Ultraviolet, again, doing the corporate accountability route and targeting Reebok to cancel their endorsement deal with Rick Ross when he had a lyric talking about drugging a woman's drink to have sex with her, to rape her. So this is work that we've always been doing. And of course, there are going to be times when there's peaks. The conversation about Chris Brown is one that began with Black women. Obviously, something like Twitter and social media amplifies it in a way that I've not seen, you know, before in my many years of organizing. And we try to use it as a tool.
I want to ask you, what about Black men in this conversation?
Some of my favorite tweets are from Black men who are talking about the conversations that are happening in their barbershops around R. Kelly over the weekend. And you're getting, I'm getting tweets from people who said the dance floor cleared out when the DJ tried to play Ignition, or that they were at the Waffle House and someone tried to, the manager had R. Kelly on and everyone, you know, started telling him to turn it off. So I'm sure they're Black men in that, you know, in those audiences, and obviously in the barbershop, definitely in the club, and absolutely at Waffle House. So Black men are a part of this movement too. They understand that while there's a spectrum of sexual and gender violence that we all need to look at in our own lives, that R. Kelly is to the left, that he is incredibly egregious, and that this is 30 years of predatory behavior where he's been abusing Black women and girls.
Dream Hampton is a filmmaker, activist, and executive producer of the new docuseries Surviving R. Kelly. Dream, thank you so, so much for your work.
Thank you, Tanzina.
I want to end today with a quick update on a story we reported on last month. Yesterday, Republican Governor Bill Haslam of Tennessee granted clemency to Santoya Brown, a 30-year-old woman who was a teenage sex trafficking victim. Brown served 15 years in prison after killing a man who solicited her for sex. Her case garnered national attention and advocacy. Now she's set to be released on parole August 7th. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.